Good afternoon and welcome to Dialect for the week beginning Sunday the 10th of October. I'm Michaela Dennis.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. Before we start, we say hello to our new listeners at Radio Verulem in St Albans. That's the Roman name for St Albans, I understand, Verulem, so I think I've pronounced that right. Coming up this week, we have an exclusive report from last weekend's big demonstration in Dunkirk across the cuts, against the cuts that are occurring in the Eurozone. Back here in Bristol, as ever, a pioneering city, we're going to be home to the country's first wargaming centre on Old Market. We get a guided tour from the boss, Alex Okolda-Dotchko.
And it's Black History Month. Bristol City Council's Equalities and Community Cohesion Officer, Simon Nelson, is here to guide us through the events that we're going on this month. Plus, Somerset rock musician Chris Betts is here. He's got a sideline also as a writer, and he's just finished his first book about a diabolical plan for global enslavement called The New World Order.
And more jollies after that with the final episode of David Southwell's Secrets and Lies, read by Malcolm Grieve.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
So we begin this week in Dunkirk. Who is running Britain these days? The City of London, Parliament, the Gnomes of Zurich, or Brussels EU? Last weekend, all eyes were on Dunkirk as the city saw one of the biggest demonstrations ever. People from all around Europe were converging to demonstrate against the cuts in public services being brought in across the Eurozone. And there was one concerted message that unemployed and working people are not prepared to pay for the fraud of bankers, as Dialect's intrepid on-the-spot reporter Anthea Page found out.
Pourquoi la manifestation aujourd'hui?
Pour les retraites. En fait, il y a un gros problème où effectivement aujourd'hui il y a plein de jeunes en Europe, pas seulement en France, mais en Europe qui manifestent pour. Qui sont mécontents de leur système de retraite. Il y a plein de jeunes qui veulent rentrer sur le marché du travail. Et nous, on voudrait partir à la retraite à l'âge qui était prévu. On ne veut même pas partir plus tôt. On veut partir à 60 ans et laisser les jeunes travailler. C'est tout.
So what union are you from? The union?
CGT, Confédération Générale du Travail, syndicat.
Okay. Est-ce qu'il y a un syndicaliste ici qui parle anglais? On a la presse anglaise avec nous et elle souhaiterait que... Est-ce qu'il y a quelqu'un qui peut faire ça? Non? C'est difficile.
He's going to find somebody to speak in English.
Today is just demonstrating, not strike.
Yeah, but why?
For the change, the time of retiring for the people. They passed, and it was 60, and now it will be 62 and 42 years of cotization for the people. People think it's too long, especially because in France also we have low wages. And the people have not much when they retire. Some have 500 euro. Most of them, it's about around 900.
A month.
In fact, you have to work 42 years to have full pension. They have to work 42 years right now. So it's 2 years more than before. Many people around 60, when they are 60, just 60% of them, they have already their 40 years. So now they have to wait until two more years. In fact, they will reduce the pensions. They will reduce, in fact, because there is no job, you know, especially in industrial areas.
What, there's lack of employment?
Yes. Many people, in fact... In some regions, I don't know exactly how many percent people work. So the idea is just to stop, in fact, the liberal way of conceiving the society. The idea is to try to stop the policy of Sarkozy, but in fact it's also the main liberal way of ruling the people.
But isn't it all over Europe, this pension question?
Yes.
Like in England?
Yes, of course. It's the, all over
countries
Europe.
Can't afford because people
yes.
are living longer.
Yes. That's what they say, but in fact it's the liberal policy that makes this. It's not a question of a nation. Of course, they have to have an average policy all over Europe. But in fact, the idea is to have to lower the pensions and the wages. We believe that it's also because they retire earlier. If you wait 5 years more, or I don't know how many years, of course, nobody knows. And in this region, the people, the average age is not good. You know, more people, it's more in the 70 and 75.
What, they die?
When they die, yes.
Oh, why do they die so young?
They say because people drink too much.
Smoke too much?
Smoke too much.
So how popular is Sarkozy at the moment?
He's really low. People don't like him. You know, it's hard to find somebody who voted for him 3 years ago. No, because, in fact, he was elected, but the people do not like him. It's very funny.
So are you retired?
No. In fact, I'm not directly concerned, because myself, I have a free job, you know.
Oh, you're a freelancer.
I will retire officially when I'm normally 67. For full pension, it's when you are 67. For many persons, it's 65, but now it will be 67. The women, they think that they will arrange things, because women are, they have sometimes a special when they have three or more children, because the policy is generally, in France, there is a policy for big families. In this case, you can retire earlier. I don't think in all the jobs, but in most, when you work in the
government jobs, civil service.
That's it.
You can retire early if you've had a big family.
Yes, you can, at least three children. So you can retire earlier. But they will lose also things. So that's why the pensions are... people are demonstrating against the low pensions, also against the age.
Good morning. My name is Philippe Ginesti.
Can you tell us about the recent problems in France with the pension and the retirement age?
Well, I don't know the difference between the British system and the French system, but I think there are two issues to be considered, cultural one and technical one. We don't have any found system, just like they have in the United States, for instance, when everybody's pay for its own generation. We have what we call a system par répartition, when people who work pay for people who are retired at the same moment. So during the good years, when the economy was climbing and when there were rather few old people, it was very easy to pay good pensions according to the fact that the new generation were much richer than the former ones. But today it's changing because people live older and older. Younger people are not so rich in comparison to our generation. The same way we were richer than our parents were. So what will probably happen in France, if we don't change the system, is that the pension will decrease deeply in the next few years.
Yesterday when I was on the march, people were saying that they wanted to retire at 60, but I think Sarkozy wants them to retire at 67. Can you explain that?
Well, the law coming to the parliament say that instead of expecting a full pension at 60, progressively, in 2 or 3 years, you will have to wait for 62 to get your full pension. For instance, myself, I was born the 8th of July in 51, And I was expecting to have a full pension the 1st of August. Now I have to wait for the 1st of December. Of course, because it's not directly from 60 to 62, but step by step from 60 to 62. Many people say, well, you're very lucky in France, because in many other countries it's later. Well, I'm afraid there is a very big deficit, and the politicians don't have the good courage to go farther. What I think, it's my opinion, it's a difference between the French culture and, for instance, the Anglo-Saxon culture. In general, French people don't have such a good economical culture. At school, we learn philosophy, but we don't learn so much economics. So people don't really understand the topics of the model, the business model, you know. Many people say, well, if I'm tired at 60, why should I wait for 62? They don't realize that if they expect to retire with a full pension at 60, the children will have to pay for them, to pay the deficit, to pay the taxes and so on. So I think that it's getting different with the new generations. But more than in other countries, I think that many French people don't understand the business model of this problem.
So you don't think many people look for alternative ways as a substitute for a pension like in England?
It's a future, of course, but how can you change from a system to another one? For instance, my generation, it was a no-found generation, so my pension will come from the first system. Well, if I say to my children, stop paying taxes and invest in your own fund, it will be good for their generation. Who will pay for my generation? During this intermediate system, they will have to pay for their own fund and for the pension of my generation. How can you switch from a system to another one?
Do you think this is going to be a really big problem for the future for any government? People are living longer and there isn't the funds available to keep them going, basically.
Yeah, I think probably it will be a very important problem because, I can't realize what will happen. I don't know. I think it's a real problem, but I don't have any wonderful idea.
You don't know the answer.
I don't have the answer.
Thank you very much to Dialex Anthea Page and also to Felipe Ginesti for agreeing to be interviewed there, reporting from last weekend's demonstrations in Dunkirk. A new group founded by Bristol National Union of Teachers and Public Servants Union, PCS, called Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, are organising a march of a similar nature and a rally in Bristol later this month. It will be starting at Castle Park at 11 a.m. and then moving on to College Green to hear speeches from some of the leading opponents of the public service cuts. And that all takes place on Saturday the 23rd of October, as I said, starting at 11 a.m. in Castle Park.
A type of hobby shop entirely new to Britain opened in Old Market last month called Cut and Thrust Games. It's not just a shop, but it's actually called a gaming centre, which is open 6 days a week for anyone fed up with video games and wants to get back to the traditional tabletop games. Dialect's Tony Gosling has been down to Old Market on a reconnaissance mission for us.
My name is Alex. I'm the owner of Cut and Thrust Wargaming in Old Market. It's a centre with 24 gaming tables for tabletop wargaming, board games, card games, collectible card games. People of all sorts of ages, sizes and shapes come here and use the space and meet each other, play games, paint, build things. And there hasn't been anything like this in the UK for a long time, really. It's a fairly new concept. It's in the States, it's in Europe, it's in Australia, and England are slowly catching on. People need space to play these games on bigger tables to be able to have as much fun as they possibly can, and it's the right sort of venue to allow them to do that here. We're talking about anything from historical recreations to sci-fi, fantasy, Lord of the Rings, anything and everything in between, really. Different scales of all sorts of things, from military modelling to sci-fi, anything really.
Over here, you can see this is some sort of starter kit here. It says the Imperial Roman Starter Army.
An Imperial Roman Starter Army, that's all of 50 English pounds there. There's all sorts of bits and pieces from Roman legionnaires to Praetorian Guard, Roman veterans, Roman auxiliaries. That basically is 120 or so models at £50. Obviously, there's all the glues and paints and bits and people here hanging around ready to give advice to build these things up. And that's the sort of core of your army, at which point you can add as many extra bits as you'd like to it and recreate any given historical battle or elsewise that you'd otherwise like to.
So can you give us an idea? Is it pretty much half and half fantasy type games and historical type?
I think the weight's heavily towards the fantasy and sci-fi market, really. Maybe there's 10 or 15% of the people here are playing the historical games, but not to say that we wouldn't want more people here doing that. The fantasy and sci-fi market has just gone from strength to strength, and the quality of the models, the manufacturing techniques that they're using to make their things are far advanced to that of the historical modelers at the moment. So, I mean, that's a big part of why more people are playing the fantasy and sci-fi bits.
Why do people want to battle away with each other on these maybe moonscapes or whatever?
It's an escape from real life, I think, isn't it? It's building your armies, it's creating worlds, conquering worlds, it's anything and everything in between, really. Tuesday nights and Thursday nights, it's great to have people coming in. It's only a new business, so I'm hoping to be open from 10 till 10, 7 days a week, really, if I can. But for the moment, Tuesdays and Thursdays do me fine, as I'm the only person working here. It's being flexible with people's free time.
We're on the ground floor now, and you can buy Mars bars and things and glue and paint.
Yeah, sure. The ground floor here is set up for introductory gaming. There's three or four tables, a painting space to learn how to paint and play, introductory tables to learn how to play the games themselves, a small coffee and tea area, and obviously retail to buy all the models, paints, glues, rule books, and everything else that you'd otherwise need, really. And there's four guys slowly working away on building some trees out of florist wire, another guy painting a couple of little bits, someone else doing some urban basing on his planetary defense force, and another person building galactic spaceships that are supposed to be 15 miles long each. But yeah, obviously they're only about an inch and a half.
My name's Tristan, and I'm currently in the process of building quite a large army or a fleet, a naval fleet, for a spaceship combat game called Battlefleet Gothic.
Now, there looks to be about 25, 30 ships of different sizes there. They're all silver, metal. That's quite a task you've taken on. This is going to take you weeks, isn't it?
No. With the right amount of super glue and some care and attention to the sculpts, and then using some of the modern sort of spray paints and things to spray, and then applying washes to it, and then re-highlighting the miniatures, I can have this sort of fleet painted up within the space of about a week, I think.
So once they're all painted, what are you going to do with them?
Well, hopefully find some of the other guys around the club that are here this evening I've been talking with, who also play this, that would be interested in starting some games and running an ongoing campaign with them.
But it look a bit formidable. I personally wouldn't want to take this lot on. Isn't there a part of that about this, that you're actually creating something which looks almost unstoppable there, and who is going to want to take you on?
This is an assembled whole battle fleet, so we would select a points value to run the game at, and then I would select from my army which forces to take to it. The opposing person would then take their selection. We would run the same points against each other, and this creates a balance that enables both sides to enjoy the game.
How long would a game like that last? And, you know, in a nutshell, how does it work?
For Battlefleet Gothic, I think a comfortable points value for these would be, say, 1,500 points. The large ship you can see there, the capital ship, they run for about 300 to 400, and then smaller ships around sort of 180, 120, and the light escorts for around 30 to 40 points each. The 1,500 point army force should run for about 2.5 to 3 hours. You're working on the percentiles on dice. You're working out the ratio of, you know, your odds of rolling a certain hit. Certain armies, therefore, will be better at shooting and have a... If you roll a dice, a six-sided dice, a D6, as it's called in the trade, and you have a guy with a higher ballistic skill and ability to shoot, the number of rolls on that dice will be more likely to hit. Three and higher on a six-sided dice will cause a hit for somebody who's got a higher ability to shoot. But then for a lower points value, you get two people who have got a less ability to shoot who can roll only hit on a five or six or something like that. It's ways in which they all balance out overall.
Is it just escapism?
I like how in-depth the hobby is in all aspects. I mean, you're talking about modelling and painting skill, which challenges you artistically. You're talking about tactics. You know, you've got to sit down and write your army list before you bring it to the fight. That sort of thing requires a lot of pre-planning, strategy. Then on the day, you're actually, you know, how your army is deployed, how you're going to actually take the other guy on, what they're bringing to the fight, and you need to weigh up, you know, those sorts of things. So there's the on-the-day style of it, the pre-planning, the artistry of it, and I think also there's just the camaraderie you get. You know, it's a great social event, you know, to sit across the table from a few other guys and have a chat, you know, and play the game and have a laugh. Great social event as well.
That was Tristan, fan of the game Battlefleet Gothic, putting the finishing touches to his Battlefleet of spaceships. And our guide and the owner of the shop was Alex Kolodochki. You can also find out more about the Game Centre Cut and Thrust games on Old Market. Next week, we'll be discussing historical games and staying with the fantasy games, taking a peep at a game where the corrupted citizens of a post-apocalyptic Bristol are skirmishing with a gang of possessed rat men. So that's going to be exciting. That coming up next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
October is Black History Month in Bristol. Today we have Simon Nelson with us, who's the Equalities and Community Cohesion Officer at Bristol City Council, and he's here to tell us a bit more about it. That's quite a title.
Yeah, it is. That's
I
quite
can
a
hardly
mouthful.
Say it. So tell me, how long has this event been going on?
Well, Black History Month in the United Kingdom dates back to the sort of like 70s period. There's no official date, but we reckon about 1978 was the first official Black History Month event held here in the UK. But it's been celebrated and its history forms in the United States. Afro-American History Month was created and they celebrate it in February, as do Canada. And I think the council have decided that, you know, there has been a bit of a lull in terms of getting Black history back on the agenda. And as a result, part and parcel of the last sort of 6 months has been trying to compile and collate what events are being taken place to celebrate Black History Month, specifically here in Bristol.
Okay, so what specifically would those events be that are coming
up?
Well,
there have been a host of events, from a cultural day specifically marking specific issues from within Black History Month to a much wider debate. So, for example, last night we had over 40 organisations from the voluntary sector who support Black and minority ethnic communities attending a form of networking day, so as we can actually share knowledge and experience and moving forward in these very lean times. I think that sort of sharing of knowledge and of skills and resources will become more and more necessary as we move forward. Two events that have perhaps been addressed for the first time as part of Black History Month, specifically here in Bristol, such as, you know, we are having events that talk about genocide, theatrical performances. There is a filming later on this month addressing sexuality in Black communities. So I think the host of events that are lined up for October in a way demonstrates how we are moving beyond Black History Month, just charting the historic achievements of Black people, but importantly looking to the future. And seeing what needs to be done in order to ensure that the history of Black people continues to be written about, and particularly from a Black perspective.
Okay, I mean, you mentioned other events for kind of other ethnic minorities. Is that also something that Bristol City Council are looking into, events for kind of other ethnic minorities as well?
Well, we do actually celebrate lots of different events specifically targeting communities. So, for example, we've had involvement at the Islamic cultural event that was held a couple of months ago in Eastville Park. And wherever possible, all of our events try to broaden the scope, if you like, of just dealing with one specific issue. But so, for example, Black History Month could very well focus on wider issues beyond sort of the African American angle and the Afro-Caribbean slave trade, as many here in Bristol would perceive Black History Month to focus on. So, yeah, I think that our aim, wherever we are supporting events to celebrate specific issues pertaining to certain communities, it really is important that we try to expand on the specific issue to include wider issues.
Absolutely. I mean, you obviously mentioned the slave trade there, and there didn't want to go over it, but obviously there's still no proper memorial in Bristol for people who lost their lives in the slave trade, despite some calls from the Black community asking for one. So, I mean, is there any plans to do that, especially with the 200th anniversary?
Well, I think in terms of when we were talking about a statue or a monument as a legacy, whilst I personally believe that there isn't necessarily a need for a monument as such. For me, the legacy is much more around the future attainment levels of some of our Afro-Caribbean young boys, for example, which is far more important if we are talking about how we can invest, if you like, in the legacy. The legacy can be now, as opposed to necessarily a monument. Although, at the same time, I acknowledge the fact that there'll be many in the Black community that want to see a statue, a monument relating to it. For me, it's very much about turning around and saying that terrible, terrible history that is, if you like, formed the basis and bedrock of this city needs to continuously be celebrated, acknowledged. But going forward, it is about making sure that we can act upon and learn upon those times now. So from slavery to racism, what is the new racism today, and what are some of the challenges for the city moving forward?
Simon, could you tell me some kind of particular highlights you're looking forward to?
Well, I think there are lots of highlights throughout Black History Month, but specifically coming up next week, you've got an event organised by Bristol and South Gloucestershire People First, which is an open day for people to come along. And this is specifically poignant for me because it's about caring in our community and challenging some of the issues within Black communities in particular. And that's taking place at the Vassal Centre on Gill Avenue in Bristol on the 13th of October from 10 till 2 p.m. And something that I want to go and see pretty close to here at the Bristol Old Vic on King Street on the 14th is an event of exceptional poetry called Verbalised. And that really is going to be a fun-packed event. There's going to be lots of singing and dancing and that. So I'm hoping to go along to that event next week.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Simon. If people want to find out more, where can they go?
The best place to go to is the Bristol City Council website, and there you'll find a link to Black History Month. You can also get copies of the Black History Month programme available from various agencies. Central Library is the best point to call for the tangible resource.
Great stuff. And the council website is bristol.gov.uk, that's right.
That's the one.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Simon.
It's a pleasure.
Now, we hear the term New World Order bandied about all over the place. But does it really mean anything, or is it just an excuse to bundle together everything about running the world we don't understand into one meaningless mishmash? One man who thinks there is such a thing as New World Order and has written a book about it, about what he's discovered, is Somerset musician Chris Betts. Hello.
Hello there.
Well, you're a musician, so let's first hear a little bit of your music as an introduction to get us in a relaxed mood. What's the song that you've chosen for us?
This first one's called Dream Ticket, and it's from a compilation that we've just put out. I suppose if you listen to the lyrics, you'll hear there's a little bit of political ranting in that.
Okay, let's hear it now.
I don't make a big thing of the political content of a lot of the songs, but I think what you believe and what you feel deeply is bound to come out in your lyrics, and it does in this one, I think.
God left his footprints on the moon. We could stop a war in Asia. We were born to grow up free. And for any dream we wanted, we only
finally had to shake the tree.
Look what came down.
That was Dream Ticket by Chris Betts. So, Chris, your new book, how long has it taken you to write this huge tome? This looks fairly sizable.
All in all, I suppose I've been researching this stuff for about 5 years now.
What is it called, your tome?
Well, basically, it's a study into the nature of the beast, as I've called it. It's a study into the New World Order.
I mean, let's discuss in a sort of research methodology for a little bit. That sounds incredibly dry, but a lot of people just sort of look at a few YouTube videos, and a couple of books about the Holy Grail or whatnot, and think they have an insight. So what do you term sort of research? What have you been doing?
Well, talking to people that I can only describe as insiders, talking to that sort of source, but also I spent a fortune on books by people who had done in-depth research, who had been in the security services, who had been in the secret services, and had, they'd reached the point that they felt they had to speak out on it. So again, if you persevere, you can find these sources.
Is it a pessimistic book, or is it an optimistic book, or what is your angle? What is your, do you think we're being hard done by?
Well, I think, for instance, if we look at Britain, I've got this here. I mean, if you recall the last election, for example, how does it affect us in Britain? Well, as you know, we've signed the Lisbon Treaty, and whether people voted for the Conservatives, the Labour Party, any of the ones that you see illustrated in these little pictures here, there were five parties. Each one of them, including the saddest one of all, was the United Kingdom Independent Party, that we saw the posters and thought, well, maybe they've got a genuine attitude of opposing what's taking place. But in actual fact, that was just a honey trap too. It was a bin vote, because the fellow who controls that, the head of that, is also a Bilderberger. So all five of those party leaders are answering to the Bilderbergers. So, it's a bit like people sitting in the stands at a horse race and saying, well, they've all got different liveries on, where the owners are sitting saying, well, they're all owned by the same stable. It's that big. And, for instance, if you look at the landmass, knocking your things over here, if you look at the landmass, I've brought some little maps here. I mean, this will give people in Britain some idea of actually what's happening in terms of Lisbon Treaty.
So effectively, what if they all attend? There's always bound to be some unifying point which, will connect five people. You're always going to be able to find something.
Yeah.
I mean, surely you just sort of, you're just being sort of like paranoid and looking for something.
Well, I would urge you to look into it for yourself. Yeah. It's up to you. I mean, I it's not my business to sort of grind an axe with anybody. Okay. What I would say is that if you look at these maps here, that's the first stage of what the effect is going to be on Britain.
Okay.
From the signing of the Lisbon Treaty, Britain's finished. It's gone. And people say, what are you talking about? That's absolutely crazy. How can you talk about that, in those terms? But it is. It's absolutely finished.
What do you mean, finished?
Well, if you look at the maps here, you've already been remapped. The counties below us, Devon, Dorset, Hants, Sussex, Kent, Essex, Suffolk, Norfolk, are now lumped in with Seine Maritime, Somme, Calvados, Manche, Ille-et-Vilaine, Côte d'Amour and Finistère to form La Manche region.
I mean, this
were never asked about it. They just did it.
That's just an administrative. Is that a negative thing?
Well, it's all sold.
You're interpreting it as negative.
All these developments are sold under the heading of trade agreements. Mm-hmm. For instance, America too is finished. America is being merged with Mexico and Canada into the North American Union, and their forthcoming currency will be the Amero. The American people, similarly, were not consulted. It was just a fait accompli. And it's actually all done treasonously, because you're really not meant, as senior officials of the government, to meet in secret with your opposite numbers. It's got to be cleared, None of this was cleared. It was all done by the presidents behind people's backs.
So I've got some insight into, what's going to happen sort of in the future there, I guess, suggested from what you said. But what does this mean for us? I mean, what can we do about this?
Well, for instance, if you think of one of the issues this year is the ID cards, identity cards. If you remember, that was sold to us, or they tried to sell it to us under the guise of the fact that it would never be mandatory, it would always be a voluntary thing. If you look at the minutes of some of those meetings, it's obvious that they were always intended to be mandatory. Now, they've said they're shelving them this year because of the expense. So, OK, you can say, well, that's a shove, putting them on the back foot. That's arrested that agenda. But I wouldn't get too complacent about it because they're bound to have something else up their sleeves.
So what you're saying we should do is just sort of continue campaigning and sort of just sort of hope that they pay attention?
Yes. I mean, for instance, I'll give you a stateside example where they were putting through the Trans-Texas Highway, which the revenue of which was going to go to the King of Spain. This is how far the multinational agreements go. The citizens actually arrested that. They've got, I think it's a year's setback they put on that because there was so much grassroots reaction. Like, the danger in, I think, is where people just say, well, what can we do about it?
Okay. I mean, how can people get hold of copies of this book?
Well, they can go to the musical website, the Connection, which I'll give you, and I'll supply them with a copy.
Okay. Chris Betts, well, thank you very much. I mean, the website, again, is www.theconnectionmusic.co.uk.
Can I just put a plug in for the little concert that we're doing here?
Oh, of course you can.
We're talking about international politics here. A close colleague of mine went for a visit to Zambia recently, came back absolutely appalled at the conditions that are being imposed on these people. There's a real poverty trap, as you know, in Zambia. It's a terrible, terrible situation. But again, instead of getting angry about the politics, you know, we want to try and do something. So the Connection and I are doing a concert on the 11th of December. It'll be in the very large Bagley Baptist Church complex, mm-hmm. which is in Wedmore, near Wedmore. And there's no admission fee for that. It's going to be an evening of rock and blues and contemporary pop and contemporary Christian stuff. But although there's no entrance fee, we want people to stuff the bins full because we've actually developed contacts right on the ground there in these places where we can get the money it counts. Okay.
All right, Chris Betts, thank you very much.
Okay, pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Conspiracy theories, love them or hate them, most of us have an opinion one way or the other. Over the last 4 months or so, investigative journalist and historian David Southwell has been doing his best to get to the bottom of some of the world's most elaborate enigmas. In the book we've been serialising, Secrets and Lies, David doesn't pretend to have all the answers, but he has applied an investigative journalist's eye to some of the most difficult of modern riddles. Anyway, I'm sorry to say that today's is the final episode from the book. The epilogue, in fact, and afterwards I'll be chatting to Dialect's Tony Gosling about the significance of the book and how the effect of conspiracy theories on the public mind at large. The first of the final part of Secrets and Lies, read by Malcolm Grieve.
Secrets and Lies, the epilogue, by David Southwell. Let us not be hypocritical. We all keep secrets. We all lie. On November the 30th, 2003, I woke up to find some of my secrets on the front page of the Sunday Times. For months, the lobby organisation I worked for, the British Retail Consortium, had been in secret discussions with MI5 and Scotland Yard's special branch about potential Al-Qaeda attacks on the United Kingdom. I had been asked to ensure these meetings were not disclosed, because unnecessarily alarming the public is a terrorist victory. As there was nothing to suggest the public were in any immediate risk, I kept quiet. MI5 did not. Whether it wanted to increase the level of fear in order to gather support for unpopular restrictions on civil liberties such as ID cards, as I was later told by my MI5 contacts, or because it had access to new information that it was not sharing with us, therefore acting in a way likely to increase the chance of a terrorist attack, it decided to leak some of the details it had discussed with us to the press. To wake on a Sunday morning to find your name on the front page and realise that you are better at keeping secrets than MI5, but nowhere near as good at lying, is an odd experience, even to a world-weary former journalist such as myself. It led people I knew to wonder what else I was keeping secret and why. As I said, we all keep secrets, and even in this book, I have held some back. I chose not to reveal the names of two CIA agents I know are currently working within the media in the UK. If I printed their names, their covers would be blown, and given their line of work, their lives would be at risk. I'm sure that both they and the CIA would not be happy with me either. I've already generated enough potential problems for myself by writing this book. Two names I desperately wanted to include were those of senior politicians who had achieved high positions of power. One of them likes to flaunt his family in photo ops, presenting himself as a loving husband and father, while having had a secret fling with a 16-year-old. I have no interest in anyone's sex life except my own. But when the happy family card is played to win votes, my revulsion at such hypocrisy rises. The other politician was someone whose own ex-police protection officer was so revolted by his behaviour that he told me, "I'd like to have shot the... myself." To have named either of these men and disclosed details of their activities would have risked putting my sources of information at risk. Therefore, because of the journalistic code of ethics I adhere to, I cannot expose their sordid secrets. The fact that other journalists also know the facts in both cases, yet have been prevented from getting their stories published, also suggests that even if my ethics had not got in the way, there would have been other good reasons for keeping quiet. I could have published the names of two well-known comedians, a major English singer, and two football players who have embraced Haitian voodoo and regularly use its magical practices. The reasons I haven't done so is because I believed they have the right to keep their religious beliefs a secret, if they so desire. If any of them had the hypocrisy to proclaim themselves fundamentalist Christians in a television interview, I might be tempted to sell the story of their cigar-smoking, rum-toting rituals and possession by ancestral spirits to the tabloids. I also don't consider such things as particularly important secrets, and certainly not the type of lie that the public ought to be concerned about. I'm much more concerned by the lies we are told about the issues that really matter and which affect the lives of millions. And I'm appalled by the cultural mendacity and media manipulation that occurs on a daily basis and which we allow to go unchallenged. Having worked both as a journalist and as a spin doctor, I can tell you with some authority that you are being lied to constantly and subtly presented with a version of reality very different from the facts every time you switch on the television, open a paper, or click on an internet news feed. Aside from the outright whopping lies, Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, no mistreatment of Iraqi prisoners is occurring, there will be no long-term occupation of Iraq, there is a constant and pernicious process of omission of facts, under-reporting of alternative views, and an Orwellian manipulation of language that would not be out of place in the Ministry of Truth, from the novel 1984. Known in the spin doctoring trade as relabeling, parents concerned over additives in vaccines become fearmongers. Pensioners peacefully protesting against the cost of the British monarchy become a small anarchist element. And in one of the best, anyone with an alternative view becomes a conspiracy theorist. If you think relabeling is not a conscious process, consider this example. Up until September 28, 2001, the Chechen groups fighting against Russian control of Chechnya were described as freedom fighters by CNN. On September 29, 2001, the Russian government pledged to back America in the war against terror. From that point onwards, CNN relabeled the Chechen rebels as terrorists. It would be easy to read a book like this and become pessimistic. It is only natural after realizing that so much of what you have been told is wrong, after realizing just how routinely you are lied to and just how much information is kept from you, to adopt a cynical attitude. Please don't. Cynicism is the worst type of cop-out. The truth genuinely is out there. You can find it in lots of places. The fact that this book has slipped through the radar is a small victory, but it is nothing compared to the tireless work in exposing secrets and lies that certain journalists do on a daily basis. The late radical investigative journalist Paul Foote has always been one of my personal heroes because, like the best of his colleagues, he was dedicated to the truth. His work helped send corrupt businessmen like John Paulson to jail, bring down double-dealing politicians, Reginald Maudling, and free the innocent that were rotting in jail, the Birmingham Six. Type the name of other pioneering investigative journalists such as Duncan Campbell or Greg Palast into a search engine, and you will get more truth than can be comfortably handled. However, don't just passively believe in something, even if it is coming from a trustworthy source. Check things out for yourself and become your own investigator of secrets and lies. Humour is one of the only ways left to slip unwelcome truths and secrets into the public arena, to share with others the horrors that we know about. The work of comedian Mark Thomas is a perfect example of this. His pioneering use of comedy as a tool of investigative journalism and the combination of jokes, stunts and relentless research has led to positive changes in UK law. More importantly, it has helped awaken many people to the fact that they themselves possess the power to confront and expose secrets and lies. When comedian Bill Hicks was asked for his motivation, he said, "I want to expose the lies and deflate the hypocrisy." It's a job he did well, but one we can all do. It is also a necessary job, because, as Bill frequently reminded his audience, the truth will set you free. Just off Pall Mall in London, near the Duke of York steps, there is a door that leads down to the covert Kew Whitehall underground complex. There is also a nearby manhole cover that is reasonably easy to lift. It would be irresponsible of me to suggest that you could investigate secrets and lies by slipping beneath the city streets. But there are thousands of other ways in which you can discover the things you are not supposed to know. The biggest lie you have been told is that you have no power to change the world. But the biggest secret is why, when you realise this, you don't get up and do something about it.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve, who read that there. That was the finale from the People's Spies Non-Dodgy Dossier. Thank you very much to David Southwell, who wrote the book and let us read it out. I'm joined now by Dialect's Tony Gosling. Hello.
Hi, John.
Okay, well, this might sound a bit obvious, but explain to us, you know, what you think. Is a conspiracy theory?
Well, I think the book Secrets and Lies goes really well into this whole concept of a conspiracy theory, and it kind of debunks this whole idea in a way, saying that many of these things are theories, but if you take a little bit of time to look into that theory, you can usually find out whether it's actually disinformation, nonsense, or whether there's actually some truth to it. So the word conspiracy theory is a bit of a misnomer in a way, in that all you need is a book like Secrets and Lies, where David has done this journalistic job of going into these things to give you an idea of whether it's true or not. And the idea is, I think, with this concept of a conspiracy theory, is to basically to discourage people from looking into it. Okay. The idea that it's a theory is actually not necessarily true, because it may well have been proven fact, and it also may well have been proven to be nonsense.
Okay, so what did you find to be the most important sections in David's book, and why?
Well, I think the most important bits are probably to do with political control. That is to say, you know, big corporations and banks, etc., that are operating totally outside the government system, outside the democratic system. And I think when you realise actually there is quite a lot of activity and lobbying by foundations, you know, tax-free foundations, trust funds and think tanks, which are totally unaccountable, and a lot of policy that is implemented day to day in our democracy supposedly comes from this, then you realise that actually there's quite a lot going on which shouldn't be going on in a democratic country.
Okay. In the 60s and 70s, conspiracy theory was the subject of very fashionable popular drama series like The Avengers and Man from U.N.C.L.E. Do you think that the conspiracy has fallen from favour? I mean, we have had stuff since, like, you know, Oliver Stone's JFK and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, in the culture of the 60s and 70s, conspiracies were all over the place and actually were probably taken a bit more seriously. And I think it's part of a sort of dumbing down process that we're being told as a collective public that conspiracy theories don't matter, that they're put out there by nutters. But actually, a lot of the people I speak to, and I would say this being a bit of an investigative journalist and conspiracy theorist myself, a lot of people I find actually enjoy conspiracy theories. They think they're fascinating and riveting, in fact, and that
some of them could quite possibly be the truth rather than just a theory.
Do you think sort of conspiracies were a little bit more simple to understand in the olden days? There was a sort of an us versus them, America versus the communists, and now it's just sort of so much more complicated and to do with sort of flows of money and all sorts of...
Well, that's interesting you mentioned the Cold War, because many people would say that the Cold War was, to a certain extent, a conspiracy fixed up by Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin during the Second World War. So basically they decided, right, you're going to have this bit of Europe, the Americans are going to control Western Europe, and we can have a big kind of, I suppose, pretend battle between the two just to engage the public. Now, obviously, okay, there was some real fighting going on, but quite whether there was really the extent of ideological hatred between the two sides, I'm not sure.
And briefly, do you think sort of conspiracies these days can become an awful lot more complicated than perhaps some of the old 60s ones were?
Yes, definitely they're becoming more complicated, mainly because the disinformation machine is really in overdrive. There's quite a lot of time and effort spent in putting theories out, particularly about things like aliens, I think, out there, that people will lap up and enjoy and believe, and that makes things a lot more difficult.
Okay, is it in the sort of grand theory of everything style, is there a unified conspiracy theory that ties conspiracies together through history?
Well, I think it's probably true to say, yes, there is, because if you go back to some of the most important conspiracy theories today, that is to say, looking at political control by multinational corporations of the Western world and other parts of the world too, that you can see that there's a tradition there which goes back and back and back, and you can trace that probably back through Freemasonry, which exists as a sort of parallel spiritual empire, really, mostly in Western Europe and the United States, and even back further through the Knights Templar, right the way back to the Pharaohs. So I think that's quite an interesting thread running through conspiracy theory through history, is this kind of clandestine, secret, spiritual government behind the scenes, right through history, right the way back to, you know, the days of the Pharaohs before Christ.
Okay, well, Tony Gosling, thank you very much.
Unfortunately, no Jeff Sparks this week, but he has written his What's On guide, so I'm going to read it to you. Good afternoon. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, the 14th of October, the Anti-Nowhere League will be performing with support from This System Kills and also Hacksaw at the Beer Keller in All Saints Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £11 in advance and £13 on the door. Moving into Friday, the 15th of October, My Passion will be performing with support from Dead by April and also the Blitz Kids at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 6:30 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. On to Song of the Week now, and let me present The Adjusters. This five-piece group hail from Wigan in England and to date have released one album called Reckless Relations. This track is from the album and it's entitled Drinking Red Wine. That was The Adjusters with Drinking Red Wine from their album Reckless Relations. For more information, you can check out myspace.com/TheAdjustersPunkAndRoll. And there's no and, that's just an N, punk and roll. On to Saturday, the 16th of October, Alan Clayson and the Argonauts will be performing with support from Alien Stash Tin at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £5 in advance and £7 on the door. And finally, on the 17th of October, that's a Sunday, Lost 11 will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place in Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week and take care and goodbye. That's from Jeff. Well, that's all for this week.
Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM at 12 noon every Sunday. So if you're outside Bristol, you can listen live on the internet at bcfm.org.uk. If you're on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday evening when Dialect goes online. You can sign up or download the podcast from our website. That's dialectradio.co.uk.
You can also find the lo-fi mono version of Dialect for dial-up connections at bristol.indymedia.org every Friday morning. Thank you to our studio guests. They were Chris Betts and Simon Nelson. Reporters this week were Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and studio production was by Lee Duffield. Thank you very much to Andrew Layton, and the producer was Tony Gosling.
Dialect is a Bristol Radio Cooperative production, and anyone can contribute. So if you'd like to do that, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can also find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Next week, we have Nick Payne and his Nomadic Tale, which is a live story written exclusively for us at Dialect Radio.
Yes, that was Dialect indeed. I'm John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis.
We're both wishing a very good week from all the team in our Queen Square studio in Bristol City Centre. Thank you for listening, and until next week, goodbye.
So don't